The domination of scientific reverence over individual bodies. Edward Sapir was tremendously optimistic, as he states. On the whole, however, there is no danger that expressive character of language will be overlooked. It is too obvious a fact to call for too much emphasis. Sapir's optimism is partly the result of his own clear views on language, culture, and communication. Sapir's definition of culture depended on a notion of genius, which implied the existence of an individual quality of speech and behavior. He looked upon it as an actualization of culture and language, as an original, individual experience. Now, if that obvious fact is abolished, then, of course, the effects of the referential forces of language become much more dominating. Sapir's views on the history of writing underline this even more. The history of writing is, in essence, the long attempt to develop an independent symbolism on the basis of graphic representation, followed by a slow and begrudging realization that spoken language is more powerful symbolism than any graphic one can possibly be, and that the true progress in the art of writing lies in its virtual abandonment of the principle with which it originally started. The history of scientific representation, however, entailed powerful symbolism by the growth of its own, more or less detached system of symbolic reverence, which creates the boundaries of disciplines. It is not the history of writing, but the history of writing about the writing, that is, epistemology. How can individual utterances ever reach this field of epistemology? Once they emerge, they are, like Barthes' closeted homosexuality, immediately incorporated into an established genre of one kind or another. I wonder how many scientists would revolve in their graves knowing what epistemology did with their individual bodily and actualization of expression. Indeed, Barthes' assistance towards classification of feelings might psychologically be interpreted as his subconscious urge and of censorship towards homosexuality. Equally, Sapir's detachment from high and low culture could be turned into an elitist form of genius. What is established by such action says more about social hierarchy, with its corresponding and persisting views about the subconscious, than it does about Barthes, who was classified as a coward, or Sapir, who was classified as a romanticist. High culture, low culture, nature, and the subconscious all serve as models for the explanatory theories of human actions. They form the elements of perceptions of the social, in which signification only exists by man's quest for partnership. What is meant by individual perception is no longer clear to anybody. What is meant by perception is never questioned. The definition of the social seems to be over-dominating, and consequently definitions of the self, equally questionable, are constructed by definitions of the social. As Sapir put it so strikingly, the conception of the self as a mere instrument toward the attainment of communal ends, whether of state or of the social body, is to be discarded as leading in the long run to psychological absurdities and to spiritual slavery. Indeed, the model of the social has replaced the social itself, as the epistle replaced the phenomena. When did we do away with the reality of individual bodies? Ironically, it was only after our models of the social were constructed that the topic of subjectivity and intersubjectivity in social theory was acknowledged. The creation and modeling of perception, individual bodies, masses, and or society, as well as their bodily terms subconscious, conscious, hierarchy, independence, etc., were quite fluent in the times of Voltaire. What he questions was definitely answered a century later and never questioned since. The epistemology of social theory largely consists of doing away, not with the object or the subject, but with questions on phenomenological appearances. It is no surprise that the signifier and the signified can also easily be split up. It is no wonder that signs are viewed as arbitrary. It is no wonder that textual reverence dominates the expressive force of language. It did not drop from the sky. Instead, we created it purposefully. We created models not as tools for research, but as a means to control the imaginary social. And then we linked it to convictions on democracy, equality, and on the economy of communication, that is, to communicate as economical or as profitable as possible. Morals are no longer about the quality of life, but about the quantity of exchange. Exchanging what? Equivalence of differences valued as same. It is against this background that the selves, images of individual bodies, are constructed, like the crusts thrown to the poor from the rich man's table, a virtual freedom which is not quite as free, or, as Sapir concludes, spiritual freedom, what there is of it, is not alms dispensed now indifferently, now grudgingly, by the social body. That a different philosophy of the relation between the individual to his group is now so prevalent makes it all the more necessary to insist on the spiritual primacy of the individual soul. For Sapir, genuine culture could not submit to economical or political bounds, as it is primarily linked to individual consciousness. That consciousness cannot but come from a perceptual difference made by the experience of an individual body. Indeed, to confuse it with subconscious patterns of economic strifes, sexual urges, or political doctrines makes its entire field to scientific reverence a lame instrument of reality. Rather, it constructs a hierarchy of status and a metaphor of the dream as text. The individual body as an enlightened animal, the causal chain of ideological terms. Like it or not, this hierarchy does come from the perceptual split between body and mind. From the split between the natural and social scientists, from the splits between animals and humans. As Donna Haraway shows in Primate Visions, we do transfer both gender relations and hierarchical structure onto the actions of animal, escaping the moral implications of hierarchy. Seeing in animals individual bodies is still condemned as a lack of rationale or as emotional transference. After all, animals do not talk back to us, and therefore they must be inferior. Animals do not fit in with language, the same way individual expression does not fit in with discourses about it. But is that a parameter for existence? Humans do indeed rule animals, and this mechanism of ruling lower strata brings about notions concerning free will and independence of individual humans. But at the same time, it is exactly the kind of ideological justification political elites use to suggest accessibility for all. Prolonging this justification onto the rest of the world, which consists of all other living creatures, creates an almost unbearable moral question towards society and its status as social. We are not animals then, we are monstrosities. It is not surprising that Descartes used the concept of hierarchy about animals, not having a soul or a spirit, and created by God to serve humans. It seemed only way to create a moral political environment for a discourse of the natural sciences. One of the few people who lamented on this mechanical discourse introduced by Descartes was Voltaire. The greatest donkeys are those who have alleged that this soul is neither body nor spirit. There's a fine system. His complaint and his ironic humor attacked first of all the hierarchy of the system by the causal change that the terminology implied. Voltaire cursed any kind of hierarchy, even though he did not connect any solutions to the situation. To him, everybody implicated his role in society, and he certainly did not have any expectations about the possibility for freedom. His fight was with the hypocrisy of his time and the historical consequences of viewing a Bible text, the holy writing, as literally. In doing so, Voltaire ridiculed the physical reverences, whether those were of animals, Christian, Jews, or cardinals. In his Philosophical Dictionary, he shows an ironic display of reverential terms. They are all alphabetized without suggesting a sequence, or more accurately, alphabetized for the sake of no sequence at all. Voltaire protested against writing, which posed of as truth by creating a causal chain of meaning, whether it was religious or scientific. It was not a coincidence that his most important philosophical themes were written like dialogues and not as texts. He, too, viewed freedom as an individual act of will that existed by its significance in acting on differentiation, not by its capacity to choose whether to spit to the right or the left. As freedom of thought was concerned, Voltaire equally wrote it as a story, and again ending in the dialogue between fictive characters. It was a way to create an open ending to each of the existing commons and concepts, leaving the reader with only some clues for further reflection about the structure of society and the fear of expression, a fear which was brought about by the existing power relation, not by consensus or agreement. The question of individual freedom has never been solved, of course. The social nature of society places the individual freedom in the atmosphere of a potential asocial. Discourses which link independency, freedom, and individualism together have created an equal amount of mutually excluding concepts. Individual freedom has become an equivalent and most capitalistic construction of the idea, everyone for himself and God for all of us. It has formed the pursuit of happiness into the pursuit of gain at the cost of the social. The idea of individual freedom has been transformed into its absolute opposite through its connection with selfishness. The individual body, therefore, has neither freedom of action nor of expression, and that is a consequence of the confined definition of freedom itself. There seems to be no freedom of perception anywhere in this world after Voltaire, and certainly not since Foucault established power relations as being productive, overthrowing the oppression hypothesis. How is it possible that open-ended stories like those of Voltaire have become such open and shut cases today? The way this process develops can be seen by the associative connections Maurice Merleau-Ponty points out in his work The Phenomenology of Perception. He describes a history of phenomenology that deals with the same contradictions and conflicts about the bodies we see today. As is the case with linguistics, the definition of phenomenology very much creates its own internal conflict. Merleau-Ponty looks at phenomenology as a study of essences, most dominating the essence of consciousness, and places it against the background of both rationalist and idealist discussions on the topic. He explains that the supposedly internal conflict of phenomenology lies in the fact that in Husserl's time, it was not completely aware of itself as a philosophy. For him, according to Merleau-Ponty, the problem lay in the supposed direct relationship between the unspoken world of phenomena and the reduction of reality through language. A firm belief in the fact that every observed thing with phenomenology had to have been observed before, the eidetic approach, ensured the maintenance of its connection with the real world through the significance of its reproductive presence. Dialectical approaches seemed the only way to handle the conflict of universalism, reductionism, and undifferentiated nothingness. The placement of undifferentiated nothingness, homogeneity and singularity on the one hand, and freedom of will, meaning community, on the other, seems to construct, at least indirectly, the hierarchy of social models. The masses need to be emancipated, yet there is no way to accomplish this task. Individuals need to become aware of their economic construction, of their contamination by Oedipus complexes, of their lack of free will, but again, there is no way of ensuring a positive outcome. Streams of consciousness entail cognitive approaches, which, through their reproductive nature, their symbolic reverence, will never aim at something as insignificant as the individual body. The entire field of perception by the body is localized in the communication of meaning and, with it, the production of power relations. If we take one step back and examine how Roland Barthes tried to bring the individual body back into the text, we can see that he reintroduced the concept of punctum, as opposed to studium. Barthes created a quite unique study of photography, which surpassed the immediate scientific reverence of what is called the studium, the sociological interpretation of images. What might have been the problem in phenomenology, that of universal symbolism or periodical modes of interpretations, for Barthes created its contradiction, not with a method of objectiveness, nor with a method of intersubjectivity, but with one of impact. It made Camera Lucida a highly personal document, which in scientific circles is rather looked upon as literature than a mode of analysis, or worse, a book to be used for teaching in universities. Barthes refers to the punctum when he talks about details and elements that prick him, a pure sensation that catches his attention. A thing might not have the same effect on anybody else, and their implication is one that changes over time. The detail Barthes felt to be important in some photographs could move along the pictures along with the time in which he himself changed and his reflection altered. He nevertheless viewed punctum as significant to begin with, not as a process developing from nothing to something, nor from signifier to signified. The irony of the punctum might be that it has significance for one person only. For Barthes, body as something entirely interwoven with his individual perceptive history that entailed both what he agreed and what he resisted in his life. But in fact, the only eidetic element in his approach is the unique constellation of such body perception. We can only be sure of one thing, which is that individual bodies do exist, whether or not it is allowed by politics. There is no dialectic approach therein. Barthes' punctum is fully differentiated, and because of that it escapes from hierarchy. For whatever, why compare such high density of differentiation, which is irreproducible, with anything that is so obviously not? But whenever the hierarchy is introduced, this personal differentiation is immediately questioned as being one of no significance, or at least quite a disturbing existence for the study of perception. Merleau-Ponty ruled it out by comparing pure sensation with the perception of animals as something inhuman, without even considering its possibility. He writes, "Pure sensation will be the experience of an undifferentiated, instantaneous, dot-like impact. It is unnecessary to show, since the authors are agreed on it, that this notion corresponds to nothing in our experience, and that it is the most rudimentary factual perceptions that we are acquainted with. In creatures such as ape or the hen have a bearing on relationship and not any absolute terms." Strangely enough, Merleau-Ponty turns something around here, especially where relationships between perceptual beings are included. Here again, undifferentiated sensations belong to animals and not humans. Nor could they be said to be individual, as relations bring them about. Merleau-Ponty, probably without intending it, gives a perfect description of the relationships that produces power, or at least everything we know about relationships that produce power. It makes no difference here whether we talk about natural biological constructions or cultural discursive constructions. For Voltaire, at least, the phenomenology of perception in animals existed as much as in humans, as well as the perspective expressions of feelings such as fear, affection, etc. Why rule out something we cannot perceive? Why create a hierarchy between the perception of man and animal for the sake of a political justification? It becomes even stranger as we look at Merleau-Ponty's idea on perception, as they in fact show that the process of signification rules out a power-producing relation as non-existent. In the same way, he connects pure sensation to undifferentiated perceptions. He also disconnects perception from pure sensation. But this entire process is based on the presupposition of homogeneity, which is never there. It is the very notion of a phenomenon of perception that without which a phenomenon cannot be said to be perception at all. The perceptual something is always in the middle of something else. It always forms part of a field, a really homogeneous area, offering nothing to be, cannot be given to any perception. I shall therefore give up any attempt to divine sensation as pure impression. However, homogeneity has never existed anywhere, except as something created as a classifying device in language. Language, as a unifying and socializing process, does exactly that. It creates an apparently homogeneous reverence. As a consequence, the work of Maurice Merleau-Ponty on freedom of power, that places both concepts in opposition, absence, homogeneity and nothingness, seem to form a sort of zero degree that recalls the oppositional structure that one can find in the work of Claude Lévi-Strauss. That is, the capacity of language to create meaning as oppositional towards nothing. Concepts like that of mana or tao or anything else would then obtain meaning because they are opposed to having no meaning, though in itself it would not have a specific meaning. Without the concept of homogeneity, the entire system of phenomenology of perception falls apart. With homogeneity, on the other hand, concepts of freedom become impossible to perceive. They are fully dependent on the position of the individual body in the status hierarchy, access to power or economic independence. Fully opposed to Sapir's definition of the genius of individual activity stands the moral obligation given by Maurice Merleau-Ponty, which creates a freedom that can never be obtained without power. Your freedom cannot be willed without leaving behind its singular relevance and without willing freedom for all. So here, the capacities of the individual body have been brought back to what is called singular relevance. What that body is becomes fully shaped towards the communal ends of society. And though, of course, everybody has the right to freedom, it is at least curious to suppose it to be a precondition for the lives and action attached to it. I do not control all relationships around and about me. Merleau-Ponty agrees with that, but for the reason that control implies existential independence. But as I've tried to show before, if I did control all social relations around me, like most political elites indeed seem to think they do, there would be no freedom. I might be able to obtain some free perception on my own life, and through it show others a possible variation of its existence. But in thought, perception and action, it would be unattainable, if not unreal, as Merleau-Ponty's nothingness implies. to rule out its singular relevance for me. It is exactly in this singular relevance for me where a difference of its perception is created, a possibility for the individual expression, and a potential for differentiation within a society, or, for that matter, a model. A singular impulse forms the beginning of a process, a differentiation by its plural signification, which is not for nothingness. The individual body expresses something, in spite of the fact that it communally seems to address somebody. The problem is enabled by the fact that existence can easily be brought back under the flag of independence. But do we really need an individual body that is totally detached from its surroundings in order to conceive consciousness of the world? Do we need an unsuccessful quest in order to prove our lack of free expression? Or is it that entire operation merely a way to overthrow philosophical existentialism? It seems that philosophy has created the impossibility of such an expression for the mere sake of divining all other subjects through the concept of consciousness. We are caught up in the world and we do not succeed in extricating ourselves from it in order to achieve consciousness of the world. If we did, we should see that the quality is never experienced immediately, and that all consciousness is consciousness of something, nor is it something a necessarily identifiable object. And so enters consciousness of the world into the field of communication, and with it, morality and truth. The unconscious becomes the something, which is not necessarily identifiable, but at the same time it manipulates and mediates truth and morality. It forces us to choose between the body and mind split of an absolute character, which would be the case of existentialism, or a connection between body and mind built on relativism of every perceptual being, which is the case with ambiguity. This is what I might call science, but it could simply be that we are not satisfied with the plain field of symbolic reverence, thereby giving science more authority and independence than language ever possessed.